Like, I don't know what to tell you. I know, like, sometimes you have to drink urine because that's how you survive in these crazy times. Welcome to Escape Chats episode 26. I'm Alan, and I'm here with a clone of Magellan. No differences, perfectly equal. Today, we're going to be discussing Season 3, Episode 5, Different Destinations, as well as Season 3, Episode 6, Eat Me. First is Different Destinations, which was written by one-off writer Steve Warland, directed by Peter Andrikides, who also directed The Flax, and it aired on April 13th, 2001 in the United States. Woo! Time travel! It's wacky!
Let's start every episode with just woo!
Gets the energy up, gets the juices flowing. Uh-huh. I really liked Different Destinations.
Yeah, it's very interesting to hear that it's from a one-off writer, because that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Steve Warland, who this is actually the only, he doesn't even like write future episodes, so I felt like it had a different vibe than a lot of Farscape.
Yeah.
And we mentioned last week how we feel like it is, like, they're heading towards better types of one-off episodes, and I think that this is exactly the type that I would love to get, because it felt like a classic adventure show where every character gets something cool to do, and the time travel plot is interesting and dynamic, and they're kind of like playing with the timeline in a very uniquely Farscape way. Even mm-hmm. the way that they go back in time is this like perfect Farscape moment where they're looking through this like weird kaleidoscope goggle situation. Uh-huh, very right. similar to the thing from I think it was Season of Death, one of the episodes recently. Where Crichton saw,
the wormhole glasses.
Right, that was from Self-Inflicted Wounds, I believe.
Yeah.
But they're seeing through this, and they're like, oh, check out this place they were in the past. There's like, they came to peace, and it's beautiful, and everything is really cool. And then poor boy Stark comes in, and he's like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this. And Crichton's like, no, check it out, it's great, check it, everything's cool. And he goes inside, and he's like, oh, it's full of, uh-oh.
Okay, so I have a question regarding the goggles, or what they're seeing yep. in the goggles. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at, just so that I have it straight, they're looking at a historical moment on this planet, mm-hmm. and it's a peacekeeper memorial, right?
Yes.
And the peacekeepers were fighting these aliens who are called the Venix, is that right?
Correct.
Which Correct. At first I thought they were saying the Benix, is that what Stark is?
Venix definitely sounds like different things. It also, I thought it sounded like Gamek for a second.
Uh-huh.
But it is Venix. It's not the thing that Stark is.
Not what Stark is. Okay.
Nope.
So they're fighting them, and they were saying something about how the goggles show one of two different moments in history. One of them is the fighting, and one of them is the peace treaty. Is that correct?
Yeah. So they saw a bunch of fighting, and then they're like, oh, this doesn't go well. And then it goes ahead, and it shows the end where the two groups have come to peace.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So that's where we're at. I felt dumb for not predicting that they were going to go back in time. Like, because they put in so, it's like, they did CG on the place, and they did so much set design, and they did all the exposition of like, this is the past, and this is everything that went on, and here are some characters, and never in that whole thing was I like, they're probably going to go back in time.
Well, that's what I mean in that it's uniquely Farscape, is there isn't like a, oh, we found this weird device, uh-oh, it sends us back. It's like Stark just has powers, and when he sees some really fucked up stuff, he just, whoops, he cracked open a wormhole that was already there, and they went through it, mm-hmm. and now they're back in time. Very classic, the way that whole thing comes about. And then they're in the middle of the conflict. And before that, though, I think it's Crichton points out that Stark's jacket is really silly. And he says, oh, you look like Astro Boy. And I wrote here, Crichton is now just writing my notes for me. He's doing exactly the type of thing that I do when I write my notes. Appreciate that. I think that was like a jacket that he got from Zahn or something. Like, he had a reason for wearing that silly pointy shoulder
yeah,
jacket.
He was like, Zahn got it for me. Yeah, it was kind of sad.
She knitted me the sweater. I have to wear it.
Uh-huh. Also great, that moment at the beginning where they're all walking through the shrine, and you're like, oh, all our cool characters are here. And then there's a subtle pan down to Stark on the stairs, just sad. It's like, oh, yeah.
Also, right. Stark's here.
He's here, and he's really sad.
Stark is consistently just a put-upon sad boy in these in just the last couple episodes. Like, that's becoming his character, and I kind of dig it.
Yeah.
Because, like, a lot of the conflict is like, why can't we just go back? And he's like, I can't find the wormhole. It's hard. And you're like, just, oh, Stark, you're so put-upon. I don't know what to do with you. So then they're on the planet. They're on the past version of the planet. It's everybody except Chiana and Pilot.
And Rigel. And
Rigel, correct. Is Rigel even in this episode?
He is. They have that scene towards the beginning when Rigel and Chiana are both on the ship, and they like accidentally find each other in Zahn's room, and they're both like gonna pillage it, but then they both get too sad and guilty to do it.
It's a good bit of character development, especially for Rigel, who we've lately been seeing just kind of like being really shitty, and then seeing him have a little bit of a heart is like, oh, okay, let's respect the dead at least a little bit.
Yeah.
Very quickly, though, in this episode, we're introduced to Daken, who I kept thinking was, like, Wolverine's son kind of thing. But it's not really dumb, corny line where they, like, learn that Daken is the person whose death propelled the peace treaty. And someone, like, there's, like, another general. And Daken comes up to him and says, like, oh, you know, the food's ready and we're getting attacked. And the guy's like, shut up, Commander, or, you know, Cook Daken or whatever. And then Dargo turns to someone and goes, that's Daken. Like... in case you weren't sure. It reminds me of one of my favorite tweets of all time, which was someone basically like goes with Date to see the movie Chappie. Chappie appears on screen, whispers to Date, that's Chappie. What did you think about Daken, I guess?
I don't know. I didn't think too much of it. I was actually finding it hard to sort out the particulars of who the past characters were, because there was that guy, the general on the other side, who was
Lino, I called him.
Yeah, Lino. I thought Daken was fine, you know? I mean, his whole character is kind of just like, I'm a nice boy who you should feel bad when I get killed. And he was a nice boy, and I guess I felt bad. I mean, Eren's son was supposed to feel bad. It was cool, the stuff that he brought out in Eren's son.
Because she
had to revert to kind of like playing the character of Eren's son as Eren's son used to be, in a way that shows how far she's come and shows that she is now making decisions that she would not have made when she was that character, like when she was her past self, because she wouldn't have exited this situation with as much remorse as she did.
Right, and she's, like, a lot nicer to Daken and, like, trying to be accommodating because she's developed more empathy.
Mm-hmm.
But she is playing that, like peacekeeper, like playing her rank, basically.
Yeah,
which is great to see. What you were saying something before though, before I brought up Daken.
I just wanted to talk about Lion-O because I was a little confused about him. So he
General
was the
Grinds,
general.
By the way, is the character's name?
What's his name?
General Grinds.
Okay, cool. Grinds.
It's hard to say slowly.
So he was the guy who brokered the peace treaty, or was supposed to. Is that the idea?
Yes.
And then they found him. Hold on. I'm going to do a quick search on this page for Grinds. And
right. Well, because there's like two generals, info. Right? There's one that they put the cloak on and then he gets killed and that propels a lot of fighting. And then there's also like the main general who kills everybody at the end.
Right.
So there may be two Vennic generals, but they both have Lion-O phases. My favorite thing about the Vennic, though, while you look that up, was just like the concept of the Vennic Horde, because it's very... not exactly historically accurate, but it's historically accurate for the show to have like an army that can only be satiated by bloodlust, and this idea that they are just a bunch of angry hive mentality kind of people of whatever race they are, and even their general can't control them, and once they want blood they're gonna get it. I thought was really a good way to propel the like tension of this episode.
Okay, so here's what I understand about this. So in the original timeline, the way it worked is Grinds, so all the peacekeeper soldiers were killed, and then Grinds was the one who convinced his army to be merciful to the women and children.
Because before that, they were killing women and children.
Yeah. And in the original timeline, he was supposed to be, when this was going on, like where they were, he was supposed to be with his army negotiating things. But their arrival in the past shifted the timeline around and made it so that he was in a different place. And they had to, Crichton was trying to return him to his army so that he could broker that peace. But nobody trusted him, and then that lady shot him.
The mom of the episode.
Right. The lady mom.
Okay, so those are both Grimes. It's just two different timeline versions of him.
Well, no, the guy at the end who actually kills him is a different guy.
Oh, okay. That guy's not, because that's the only time that guy appears, basically.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah.
There's so much. I don't even know where to start. I want to talk about Jewel real briefly.
Yeah, I got some stuff to say about Jewel.
We're getting more Jewel moments now in the show, and Jewel's role apparently is to just get fucked over consistently.
Right.
She's like the comic relief, but like it's the stuff that happens to her, not the stuff that she does. Because she immediately, like 2 seconds into them being in the past, she gets shot with an arrow. And she's like, well, I'm just going to scream, and that's going to be our cold open. And then she drinks pee, which is a dumb joke. I'm drinking piss.
Piss.
Which is like the thing the nurses give her to numb the pain. She's like, oh, this is really great. What is it? And they're like, oh, it's, you know, some fluids and then also like some weird alien piss. And she's like, ew, what? It still works, honey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know what to tell you. I know, like, sometimes you have to drink urine because that's how you survive in these crazy times. What did you think about Jewel, though?
She has like a different level of slang that she's operating on than everybody else, which is odd to me because her character is like she's a noble woman, right? Or she's just from a more moneyed aristocratic background.
Right.
But her language seems a lot more casual and more earth-like, I guess.
A lot of slang also.
Yeah. And she also, her swears are different. Like she says bitch and she says piss and she says bullfrel.
That's a good point. I didn't notice bullfrel.
Bullfrel was so weird. That's bullfrel.
I guess because she is kind of this like weird mix of like human characteristics and whatever her race is.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that is the reason for that. I think it's just like they're playing around with those swear words some more.
Yeah.
And they are writing a lot of those for her.
Well, and maybe since this was a one-off writer.
Oh, true. Maybe that have, the full grasp of how that language stuff works.
Yeah, that might be part of it.
Oh, Steve.
But I like Jewel. I don't know. I like having her around because she reacts to things differently than anybody else does, and she gets herself into different situations. I think she's still very much, like you said, a character to whom or at whom things happen, as opposed to a character who does things in a way that if it continued this way, it could get problematic for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think the jury's still out on how I feel about her power being that she screams. Yeah.
I like that even though it's her power, people are still consistent. Like, it never helps. People are just consistently annoyed by it. I think there's like maybe in this one or the second episode, she starts screaming. They're like, don't scream. You're going to melt something. Stop. God.
Yeah.
Just chill. Julia, that is a good point, though, about the whole, like, if she is always having things happen to her and not doing things, then that's, like, not a great way to write a character, especially a female character. But I also wanted to bring up the line. I don't remember the whole, it's two parts. I think Stark says it. It's like, do right by the wrong, and then the goddess will sing a song. Like, he's recanting something that Zahn used to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, a cute little rhyme, and it really made me feel emotional at how the legacy of Zahn has like carried on in everyone's minds, because she's like this kind of person that would say all these truisms and all these religious things, and everyone was always just like, oh, Zahn, you're weird. But they like clearly retained all of that stuff and compartmentalized it, and they use it. So it feels like she very clearly left a mark on them, even though she's not on the show anymore. Like, her presence still exists.
Right. But it also feels like we're going into territory where that stuff can't reassure us anymore.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, her legacy is around, but also we're now it's time where, like, we really could have used Zahn. Like, Zahn would have really helped us be calmer or be more level-headed about what's going on. But things are getting dark and bad.
And spoopy.
Spoopy. Jewel and Stark had a scene together, I think, and it was just too much scream on one team. they're just both like crazy.
They're very shouty and occasionally angry and stressed a lot.
Mm-hmm. Jewel was also in a scene with Qiyana. Do you remember this part where Qiyana like punched her or slapped her in the face or something?
Yep.
Yeah. I was a fan of that.
People have told us that the relationship between the two of them is like one of the better ones on the show right now because it's developing really quickly. And it goes from like, we just hate each other to this almost like sisterly, like, oh, you are so annoying to me, but like, I appreciate that you're here sometimes. Like, you know, it's slowly getting there.
Right.
But it's still in just like acts of mild violence, I guess. But I'm actually really curious to see where they go because they're, I know there's a lot of potential for that is basically what I'm saying. They're like the two youngest people on the ship and I think it can blossom into something.
Yeah.
Aaron and Dargo are the only ones without, this is speaking of character pairings. Aaron and Dargo are the only ones without voices in their head because Jewel at one point like falls into one of the futures that is not supposed to happen or something, or like the oopsie past. No. She goes back to the ship. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's like around the same time that she hangs out with Chiana, and it's like in the future where like, the thing that we messed up in the timeline. And I thought this was really clever, by the way. Like the planet is now cracking and falling apart because of the war that we helped instigate by accident. And if the planet is destroyed, then we can't. We have nothing to go back to. Like kind of like a cool sort of bit of stakes building.
Yeah.
That they do.
I mean, it kind of like any time travel story. It falls on. It, like, fails scrutiny, I think, because it just doesn't make sense that in the future they would, in real time, see the planet changing.
Yeah.
But it's a cool visual, and I let it slide because I didn't really care that much.
And because over the course of the episode, it, like, goes from a couple cracks in it to gone in, like, a couple minutes. And you're like, is that how a planet gets destroyed? Is it really that fast? Like, their viewing of it is, like, so accelerated. It's kind of funny. At one point, so basically the whole thing is like they meet Dakin and they're like, you are just a cook, but you in the correct timeline are going to like try and send a message with an attempt to broker peace. Someone's going to kill you when you send it, and then that's going to have them be like, oh no, we killed an innocent person, and that's going to be how peace comes about. And it becomes this cool argument between Aaron and John about like, can we prevent another innocent death if it means that we can, but is that going to mean that we're going to break the rest of the timeline? Because at this point, we know that Dakin's a good person and that he has a part to play in life if he were to live. But John is kind of saying, like, the timeline is as it is. We cannot mess with things, which is a very John Crichton line. Like, we need to stick to the plan.
Yeah.
Interesting, like, leadership roles discussion between him and Aaron and all of that. Because I never really thought of her before now or before the last couple episodes as, like, the person that wants to save all of the lives. She sort of seemed like the practical one for a while. But in this one, because she gets to meet Dakin and because she gets to be that peacekeeper character that she was for so long, she's like, oh, now I have investment in this scene and investment in this scenario that I want to see if we can fix.
Right.
If we have the ability to go back in time, we have the ability to change things. But then the message of the episode becomes the classic time travel thing of like, you can never change things. But it comes about in a very uniquely Farscape and kind of like... Twilight Zone-y way,
right?
Where
yeah.
It doesn't happen the way you wanted it to, but it does happen, which I thought was great. They get a flame arrow message though at one point, where like one of the generals is like, "Hey, we don't want to broker peace or something." Or no, that's when they're like, the guy's like really mad that they tried sending over, what's his face, Lino, over to them, and they're like, "Oh, screw you!" But the way they send it is like it's a flaming arrow, and then in the fire there's like a hologram, which I just thought was a cool touch because it could have just been like a piece of fireproof paper or something, but they just had to make it a hologram because it's Farscape and it's great.
Right.
At this point, once the plot starts sort of accelerating, Scorpius is like, oh, I'm supposed to be in this episode too. And he has that great scene where he's just in red cowgirl boots and he's like lying about on the in the bass or whatever. He's like singing, or he's playing the harmonica. He's playing like, I forget what song it was. I wasn't able to pick to identify it, but I definitely heard it before.
Yeah, I don't remember.
He's playing like a cute old timey song on the harmonica, and that becomes the time for him to be like, Creighton, what's your plan? And you know, he's kind of like, oh, we got to stick to the timeline. And then Scorpius is just basically like, well, then do it. Don't waffle forever.
Yeah, he's playing Home on the Range.
Yes, which is appropriate because he also mentions like, oh, this is just like all those Western movies you used to watch.
Yeah, that was a really well shot moment of the reveal of the harmonica, because you're panning over the whole group and at first you don't even notice because the music feels like it fits, so there isn't that question of, oh, who's playing the harmonica, and then as it keeps going it's like, oh, is this going to be a scene where somebody's playing the harmonica? And like, oh, is John going to be playing the harmonica? And then it pans over John's face and he's just dead serious. It's like, whoa, what?
Who's playing it?
Oh, my. Whose boots are those? Oh, whose leather pants are these?
Who else could it be but Leatherman himself? Yeah. Scorpius.
And then, so it's that whole, it just moves you so slowly from not noticing to being kind of annoyed with the trope to going crazy because that's such a cool reveal.
Yeah. In a couple of seconds, that scene, just the way that it's shot, conveys a lot.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that convey a lot, but in kind of cheesy ways, so you were earlier referring to the woman that shot the general. I don't remember her name, but she had a daughter, who I thought was a really good actress, actually.
Yeah.
For her age. She like brought, Cintrina is the younger person's, name. I think her mom's name is Kelsa. Love Farscape names so much. Kelsa's the one who's kind of like the leader of these nuns or whatever, the like nice folk who are being protected by peacekeepers, and her daughter Cintrina has this really beautiful relationship with Dargo that forms during this episode. I like that stuff a lot, but as soon as they like became friends, I knew that what was going to happen was something from her life is going to affect the future, and they're going to see it at the end and you're going to be like, aw, touching.
Yeah.
And I was right. But, again, very Farscape, they didn't do it in the way that I thought. It wasn't like, well, the only person left on this base is Cintrina because she's old now. Because they have that cute moment right before they leave where he kind of goes like, how long do people of your race live for? And she's like, my grandmother lived for 300 cycles. And he's like, oh, cool. I'll probably see.
Yeah. And then she gets killed.
Right, because of the way that the ending pans out.
Yeah.
I wrote some stuff about Chiana and Jules' relationship. Do you have any notes before we start to get towards that big ending, though?
I guess. Huh. So the time stuff, I think it kind of, I had the same question about their motivation in this episode that I always have about the crew's motivation whenever they're put into a sort of traditional sci-fi hero team role, which is like, why do they want to reset the timeline? You know?
Reset it to what? Reset it to back to what it was?
Yeah.
Hmm. I think it's partly altruism.
Yeah.
You're like, but it's like reset it back to what it already was. So I think that's just like the, is it worth change? Like, are we going to try and change it or should we just leave things as they are and then leave? Because they don't want to be the like.
Right. And I think, I think part of it is they just didn't have an exit and then they probably would have taken their exit if they had it sooner.
Right.
But also, they do change time and it doesn't actually affect anything. Like, this is a pretty well insulated pocket of causality that we're dealing with here. That, I don't know. It's really hard in my mind to justify a time travel story like this where you can alter something in the past that it's only affecting the future of this planet specifically. And I think some of the characters even comment, like, oh, it was just stuff was just happening to this planet. Like nothing else was going on.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Again, it's more stuff that like when I was watching, I set it aside. But I think it's a testament to the fact that time travel is so tricky to play with. And because you have to like set so many rules as to how it works and what the stakes are, what the consequences are. That it's hard to construct character motivation concurrent with that, I guess.
Exactly. And the choice to set it on one planet and have it be a localized thing is very smart because they're playing very carefully with time travel rules in this episode. But then that gets to the, like, sort of, tragic in a way question of what the crew is trying to do, where it's like, if y'all just left as soon as you got here, like, you could have found the portal again. And you just left and let things stay exactly as they were, everything would have been fine. But you tried to change things, and then you said, no, wait, we can't change things. Like, they had to have that whole arc.
True.
Which I guess, in a way, is, like, it is character development for the whole crew of Moya, which is, like, we are learning that we can't always be the people who come onto the planet and save the day. Like, sometimes we have to just let history happen. Like, a lot of this episode is about respecting history and respecting people's lives and pasts and not trying to create an idealized version that makes sense to us.
Right.
So again, I think that's like a more mature and sort of like higher level of intelligence than Farscape has been in a long time.
I think something else about this episode, the way that it's constructed, is that it the question of Daken is it's a good one because it's kind of a microcosm of like the crew has to really figure out their philosophy in terms of utilitarianism. Like, do they believe that there is a greater good, essentially? And what does that look like? If that's something that we want these characters to grapple with going forward, I think this was a good place to start thinking about that. And what is the value of a single life compared to others? And then also, like, the lives we're saving are in the hundreds of years ago past. So what is the point of that? I don't know.
Right.
So lots of questions about, like, what is a life worth saving? What is a life that, like, what are the conditions under which we sacrifice somebody for others? Is that even something that we're allowed to decide? A lot of cool questions coming out of this episode if you accept it at face value in terms of its rules and its time travel.
And that's a good thing to do in general with Farscape, is to kind of, like, come to accept its rules, and it's a thing that we've struggled with throughout this show. But I've heard, I think someone referenced in the comments on last week's episode, that at some point Rigel is going to bring up a point, like, basically talking to the audience and just being like, hey, shit's weird. Like, we're not going to be able to do everything and have it, like, be clean and work out. Like, that's not the type of show we're trying to make. We're about characters and we're about having fun. Like, at the end of the day, that is where we're putting all of our focus. But I think that Different Destinations is a relatively stable time travel story in the broad scheme of things. Stable in terms of, like, not too many plot holes, other than, like, the motivation stuff that we talked about. And then, yeah, as expected, it ends with the... Well, there's, like, the really cheesy moment with the drums coming in where Daken climbs the thing. And then just the fucking line. What does he say? He's, like, about to shoot the arrow. And then Aaron's son goes, "You're so brave." And he's like, "Me? I'm not brave." But, you know, they call people brave when they're about to... when they die. And you're like, oh.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not gonna die.
I'm not gonna die. That'd be wacky. So corny. But it's, like, charmingly corny. And then he, of course, gets shot and dies. And then they're like, yay, we broke a piece, probably. And then they leave, and they get to go back. And they are in the present again, and the planet is still there. And they're like, I think we did it. And they look through the machine again. And what they realize is that guy got killed, but it didn't broker peace. Mm-hmm. And the general came with the Horde and came in and was like, oh, all of you guys are going to die. The people... unless you tell me where John Crichton is, because he's the bad person, with the pulse pistol. I love that the pulse pistol is a big part of the plot, too. Like, the concept of, we have advanced weaponry that can kill so many of them. Mm-hmm. There's, like, those scenes where they're doing the siege, where the Horde is trying to come in, and Aaron and John are just, like, wrecking dude after dude with just two pistols because of the superior tech. And then they're like, we don't know where Crichton is. We don't know. And then... it's like the moment where the general's like, I don't know, like, his Horde takes over and he has nothing, no control for a couple seconds, and he's like, and then they all get killed. It's sad. And then the crew is back on the planet, and the episode ends with Dargo looking at a wall, and of course Sinchina's mark that he told her to leave is still there, even though she is not. Sad. I think that was all of the stuff from the actual episode that I wanted to bring up. Do you mind reading me the background info from the Farscape Encyclopedia Project, Magellan?
I don't mind it, and in fact, I'll do it. Hey,
thank you.
Guess what? Again, Krace does not appear in this episode. I wonder when he's coming back.
Weird.
Virginia Hay is removed from the credits as of this episode.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah, me neither.
those credits are really busy, and they're not, like, classical, like, oh, here's John's weird pose. It's just a lot of fast... shots.
Yeah.
But alas, Virginia Hay.
A full-size courtyard was built on the lot for this episode, complete with sand and a giant statue. That's fun.
Cool. Yeah.
Oh, here we go. The makeup for Grimes was based on the Lion Man version of Sean Connery.
So I like that a lot.
You had it right.
Yay.
When Harvey leans back and props his cowboy boots on the table, the name Andy can clearly be seen on the bottom as an homage to Pixar's Toy Story. Ben Browder had written it on the boots.
What the fuck? I didn't see that.
I didn't see it either. That's cool.
Yeah.
Home on the Range is played by composer Guy Gross, who was taught to play the harmonica as a child by his father. Wayne Pigram had to mime playing the harmonica as he didn't know what song would be used for the scene.
Can I be pretentious for a quick second?
Yeah, please.
As someone who knows sort of how to play the harmonica, I could tell that he was miming it because he was like moving his hand up and down in a way that you don't need to. That's like a thing that they do in movies when people are playing the harmonica because it makes it look more like, oh, look at me. I'm really good. I'm wiggling my hand.
Hmm.
It's just a lot of sucking and blowing. It's really the harmonica.
There you go. Sucking and blowing. Jules' behavior was suggested by Tammy McIntosh, who thought that being drunk would be a good side effect for the urine.
Can I really quickly? This is a dumb paragraph. Tammy McIntosh, apparently, I love her, like what I've been reading from the actress herself about how she's playing Jewel, because she's clearly having fun with it from minute one. That was where I thought I had, this is from the Farscape and Illustrated Companion for season three.
Okay, keep going.
That was where I thought I had really found the character. When I had to drink the piss, it made it seem like it made me drunk. I was feeling really silly and stupid that day. There was no reference to that in the script, but I thought it would be fun. She's just hanging out. Just wanted to act drunk.
You want a fun piece of trivia here?
What's that?
Before the series, Tammy McIntosh and Anthony Simcoe shared a flat while she was a backup singer in his band.
What? Oh, actually, we found out before that he had a band, I think.
Well, there you go.
I really want to hear Anthony Simcoe's music. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm. Peter Andrikidis stated that the episode reminded him of the Back to the Future films, but with a much darker twist. Yeah, I was going to say that the planet thing was kind of a large-scale version of the photograph fading.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Peter Andrikidis was who?
He's the director of this episode.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. The scenes on the battlements were high off the floor, close to 15 feet up. Oof.
Oof.
Significantly, this is the first episode in which John is shown explicitly seeking Harvey's counsel regarding potential options, although Harvey declines. That's a cool... I think we kind of saw the beginnings of that before, but I'm really excited for where that goes.
Yeah, the idea that it's no longer like one of them is bothering the other one. It's like John is asking for the help.
Yeah, you're here, so we might as well chat.
Yeah, that's a clear like evolution of that relationship. There's a couple brief anecdotes in the Farscape Illustrated Companion that I'd like to read for people because I think they're funny and they weren't in the background info. This is just an Anthony Simcoe quote. I love sieges on films. And I also like that episode because of the relationship that Dargo has with Sintrina. It's the introduction of the third phase of Dargo as he makes some really mature decisions. I'm really curious what Anthony Simcoe thinks were the first two phases of Dargo.
Yeah. Huh.
And like that he is imagining the character that he's playing as having these stages. Or maybe he's just like quoting something that someone else told him, like your character's gonna have three stages of development, but
maybe like that's something that he's thinking for himself.
Right. And then this is just a short anecdote again about Tammy McIntosh that made me laugh. Because there's a scene where she falls back. This is another like comic relief moment for her where she falls into mud.
Mm-hmm.
McIntosh risked the wrath of the makeup department when she rolled in the mud. Under no circumstances was that $6,000 wig to be put through the mud, she recalls.
Oh my god.
Because it would take at least 10 hours to wash it and retong every one of those curls. So McIntosh sent her makeup artist away from the set briefly. I said to Peter, quickly, quickly, let's do it. So we shoot the scene, and then Anna walks back in the door, and her face is white. Her jaw's on the floor, and I'm rolling in the mud, loving it. The wig is absolutely trash. It is brown, the curls have dropped out, and it is just a dead, muddy wig. Anna didn't talk to me again for about 3 weeks.
Oh my god.
Doesn't that seem like a weirdly Jewel thing to do also?
Yeah, yeah.
That really tickled me, like... The idea that she's just like, fuck your wig. I'm going to roll in the mud because it's fun.
Oh my God.
I wonder if she's actually difficult to work with or if that's just like a joke. Like she didn't talk to me for 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That is the background info for Different Destinations. Majone, would you like to take a quick break with me? And then we'll come back and talk about Eat Me.
Eat Me. I'm a twin, by the way.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Moya Bag for episode 26 of Scape Chats, where we read your feedback and I comment on it. First up, we got twitter.com, where you can tweet at us at Scape Chats and send us comments, concerns, and memos, like does every week. They brought up a couple points about Zahn's death and how it hurt because she was dying anyway. At that point, she's weakest, and why let anyone stronger go if you can be spared? The core of Zahn's death scene is that she knows she can be spared. She is willing. She knows they can be strong without her, But Aaron will not let her go. She has to be held back physically by Crichton. They know it's unfair, but it's their best option. And even if it isn't, Zahn is willing. She is willing. And then their actual memo mentions how Tony Tills is the shit, and his use of lighting and framing was fantastic and innovative. And they referenced how we mentioned that they are getting better at using the whole cast in scenes, and kind of said, ha ha, honey, to that, which I guess is meaning that that's going to be a thing that they do way better over time. What if Aaron mispronounced that thing and Niala translated the mispronunciation as an entirely different word? What if she was trying to say something in Sabbatian, couldn't pronounce it, and then called Niala a smirp in Nabari? So Niala translated the mispronunciation as smirp. which I love that translator microbes are spreading to our crew members as they were for us early on. Farscape is genre savvy, and that can make it break out, make or break it entirely. Nope about Niala's people following them forever. This is the only exception to that consequences thing. Chiana crossed Jewel, becoming less sassy and bitchy is the best, but they're going to bitch at each other a lot for the next episode. And the last Aaron and Stark scene is very creepy. Claudia talks about that, Stark handing her the plug, and Aaron looking high-key terrified. That scene was meant to be gross, and it does set up their arc. For the record, Different Destinations is good, but I am not watching Eat Me. Trigger warning, eating alive, trigger warning, blood seizure, warning, vomit, warning. This is Farscape's first and only horror episode, which this comment is the thing that I bring up when we first start discussing Eat Me. And they said, I did have the stomach flu when I watched it, and I was vomiting periodically, but still, it's a hazy fog of terror, disgust, political incorrectness, and holy fucking shit on a visceral level. That episode and They've Got a Secret are the only ones that they haven't watched in full. Thank you so much, Omens. We really appreciate your memos and your comments. They're great. Moving on to the Reddit thread, which you can always find at reddit.com/r/farscape. We have a long comment from Blue Blaze Spear, who says that when you referred to Stark and Zahn as the classic bad boy meets and falls for dying woman, I thought, is this the Farscape A Walk to Remember? P.S. I'm glad we no longer have to tiptoe around Zahn's death when talking about the character's diminished role and Virginia Hayes' departure from the show. You could start to see the writing on the wall for Zahn pretty early on with this story, and how she has a one-on-one with each of the Moya crew that subtly highlights what she's meant to each of them. Part of that took some of the energy out of Zahn's death scene for me, because it had been telegraphed so thoroughly. I'm glad they gave us these closing moments, but the cost seemed to be, for me at least, that for most of the episode, part of me was preparing myself for that scene. I don't think I've ever decided if I like Jewel or not. Everything about how her character is introduced seemed to suggest no one on Moya likes her, and you probably shouldn't. But she's okay after a while? She's a personality type that they haven't had to deal with. You mentioned that Zahn's departure causes crew members' roles to change, and I found one of the more endearing new ones to be the big sister, little sister stuff that Chiana starts having with Jewel. Something that bothered me about these episodes, the first one particularly, is how much blame gets put on Crichton for how things go down. At best, I would say that he's tangentially responsible for an accident that nobody could have predicted, and Jewel blames Crichton for the death of her companions when, again, I'd say his direct culpability is suspect. But I understand what they're trying to do with his psyche, and it feels a bit ham-fisted. Generally speaking, though, I'm fond of these episodes somewhat in their setting of the tone for the things that are to come. And TRK2 references that they remember not liking Jewel during the original airing, but we are going to learn to like her and appreciate the perspective that she has in that she repeatedly points out the insanity of things. Because that used to be Crichton's perspective, but he's become numb to the chaos, so she is the character that's most relatable to the viewer, which I think is a really good point, TRK2. And yeah, they kind of go back and forth. And then Exatron says, I had Zahn's death spoiled for me before the episode aired. She did an interview on USA the previous Halloween and mentioned that she was done filming her last episode. And that kind of ruined it for me. And finally, Maridi says, I like that the podcast feels that it's more conversational, not because of the sync issue. I much prefer that you don't do a play-by-play of the summary, but that you just do an official paragraph summary and discuss it, which we have taken that feedback and started doing it. I do love Jewel. Love, love, love Jewel. I will admit that I disliked her in this episode and the next one. But then I felt very connected with her during her scenes in Eat Me, which I agree with. There are incredible parallels between her and me, in that I have a PhD in archaeology, which is one of her things, and she approaches things similarly to how I do it. It does seem like the blame on Crichton is intensified, but then again, they're stressed out, and I can see how annoyed they would be at him. I didn't know that Zahn would die beforehand, and I was still hoping to the very end. Translator microbes, it has already been stated that there are words that are not fully translated, like Frel, Hasmana, Arn, etc. And then they kind of go into examples of that. Some side notes. 40 years of travel, if only there was time travel. which, referring to how we were confused by how Crichton was excited that he don't have to travel 40 light years from the other side of the wormhole to Earth. Pilot is definitely losing his patience with the crew. He gets really mad at Crichton Dargo. And then they talk about Eat Me, and there's some gifts in there, too. Finally, we have an email this week from Dax Static. I'm not going to be able to read all of this, Dax, but it's a really, really good email. It's actually about different destinations and Eat Me, and how they liked how Eat Me is basically a horror story, and you've got your zombie guys running around, the walls of the ship are rotting, there's a mad scientist feeding his children, and to top it off, they take one of Farscape's most beloved characters, Pilot, and show us a madly depressed version of him who's been living in hell for who knows how long, begging for death. Each character has to deal with their own troubles in interesting ways, and we're going to talk about the whole, like, Dargo's problems in the set and how some of that becomes kind of problematic. And yeah, Farscape doesn't shy away from killing its own characters. We saw this with Stark, even though he wasn't a main character at the time, and he came back. Zahn died, she ain't coming back. Aaron died, she came back. Keep this in mind for future episodes. Anyone can die at any time. Going on, John has to deal with trying to help Pilot. He's witnessing firsthand him getting eaten and begging for death. Does he ever make up his mind after he gets the parts they need? We never get an answer, as the pilot is speared in the head. What would John have done? John seems determined to save the day, maybe because, in the last episode, we saw how all those women in his past, in the past, got slaughtered crying out his name. So when the alternate pilot yells out Crichton, he doesn't hesitate to run to him. But again, too late. And Jewel, who's basically the coward of the episode, even if it's done in a comedic way, is developing slowly over time, regarding her courage at least. So even though Chiana and Dargo will have to deal with their doubles in their own way, John does not have that option. His twin is here to stay. Or is John the twin? This is my favorite storyline of the entire Farscape series. When I think of the show, the two Johns are what I think of first. The way the writers allowed this story to continue for as long as it does, rather than a quick fix, is very ballsy and one of the reasons I not only love the show, but I flat out respect it. As you watch future episodes, ask yourselves, and I'm going to pause this to the listeners also, which John is the real John Crichton? Is one more real than the other? What about Harvey? Who will Aaron choose? Or which one will choose Aaron? I look forward to hearing your discussions on the podcast. Enjoy. P.S. My favorite quote from the episode. See? Violence. You'll get the hang of it. Which is Chiana after getting Jewel to hit her. Yeah, there's more in here also, but I love these emails, and you can send those to scapechats@gmail.com if you ever want to email us something. Thank you, Dax. I hope that didn't go on for too long. Thank you to everyone who sent in feedback. Let's get right into Eat Me, and then we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. And we're back. The second episode that we watched this week was Eat Me, which was written by first-time writer and longtime member of the Australian alt-rock band Machine Gun Fellatio, Matt Ford, a.k.a. Pinky Beecroft. And it was directed by Ian Watson, airing April 20th, 2001 in the U.S.
What?
That's true. Matt Ford was a musician that they hired to write one episode, and he was in a band called Machine Gun Fellatio. That's 100% true.
He wrote other episodes.
He wrote Meltdown and I Yench You Yench, which we're getting to this season. But this was his first episode.
That's awesome.
That's and his name is Matt Ford, but in the band his name is Pinky Beecroft, which is the most Australian thing. And then, of course, he was paired with Ian Watson, who is a long, long time director on the show.
Yeah, he's our boy.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his work. Eat Me was a weird episode.
Yes.
This was built to me as... Oh, Magellan. We can do better.
Sorry.
It's good. No, it's chill.
I wasn't paying attention.
This episode was built to me, at least, as the first and only time that Farscape tried to go full-on horror. And I think it worked a lot, at least in the first, like, 3/4 of it. And then it saddled in the back end with setting up something very huge for the rest of the show, or at least for the next, like, short while. I don't know how long the...
Very huge.
Oh, we have Mr. Trump on. You're no longer allowed on the episode. Sorry, you gotta go. Never come back. Nope.
I just wanted to... All right.
Do
you know there are a lot of... image macros online of Donald Trump and Rigel, like, side by side.
Whoa, it works. That reference tracks 100%.
Yeah, go home, take a look at some of those, folks.
I'll make one of those the episode thumbnail, but I like there's a lot of good screenshots in both of these. I guess before I read the summary, what did you think of Eat Me?
I watched it in two chunks, which I think contributes to kind of like a dreaminess that I associated with it, like a kind of out of body, which is also in large part due to how horrific it was.
Yep.
Horrific, not mean bad, but like scary. It was actually, there were scary parts. I appreciated it doing a tone. I appreciated it doing a tone that I hadn't seen on Farscape before. This is not my Farscape. This is not what I want it to look like.
Hashtag not my Farscape.
Not what I want it to look like most of the time, but this and Different Destinations shows that we're entering a space where we can do one-off episodes that are very wide-ranging in terms of tone, but still come from a place of tackling kind of, I guess, alternative plot lines or approaches to plots that you don't see in other shows.
It is, I really, again, I agree that in that I like that they're playing with genre, and I think that's a big thing that season three is starting to toy with. Because you could argue even Different Destinations is like a time travel episode, and maybe that's not the most standard fare.
Well, and it's a Western. Thing. There's Western in there, too.
True. It is very much a Western. So, like, genre is becoming a thing that they can kind of play with, because sci-fi doesn't have to be, like, we're going to visit a planet and do political stuff, like a lot of, whatever, like, Stargate, Battlestar, et cetera, those are.
Yeah.
They get to do as much stuff as they want, and especially because this show is so weird, they can do a full-on body horror, body swapping kind of thing, and it works relatively well. But again, I don't think this is the best genre for them to take on, just because the show is already so weird that, like, when you see the like corrupted ship, it doesn't seem like the weirdest thing that Farscape's ever done.
Yeah,
like, visually, I feel like this episode disappointed me in terms of how scary it looked, but there were certain things that me watching this at 1 a.m. a couple nights ago, I jumped. There was a good amount of like solid jump scares.
Sure. I also find it interesting that this episode is kind of like a few different Farscape episodes thrown into a blender. There's traces of like, was it called A Bug's Life? What was that second episode? Yeah.
A Bug's Life, yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, oh, there are copies of us on the ship. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of that. There's a little bit of the icky, scary Aaron pilot hybrid style prosthetics from, what's it called? DNA Mad Scientist.
DNA Mad Scientist, good job.
And there was also, it felt a little bit like Crackers Don't Matter in the sense that there's a weird guy who's making everything weird in his way, except that he's a scary weird instead of a silly weird.
Yeah. The way they build up the villain in this episode is really cool, but he's terrifying.
Yeah.
Will you allow me? I don't know why you would not allow me. I'm going to read the summary of this episode
from
Farscape. Oh, fine. Well, okay, if you say so. No, this is from the Farscape Illustrated Companion. This is a sort of like paragraph summary. I've been told by people that they prefer us doing this at the beginning instead of like trying to hit every plot point because, again, people have watched these episodes and they don't need us to hit everything. So this summary is kind of like a, hey, here's all the stuff we're about to talk about.
Great.
Separated from Moya and running out of oxygen, Crichton, Dargo, Chiana, and Jewel think they have reached safety when they spot a Leviathan. Then they see a Peacekeeper control collar and realize it is not Moya.
No.
But they are out of options, so Crichton sets course for the ship despite the others' reservations. Upon landing, they try to make sense of the decay that permeates the ship, but quickly come under attack from a strange creature. Wanting to get away as quickly as possible, Crichton and Dargo head off to find the parts they need to repair their damaged transport pod, while Chiana and Jewel remain in the maintenance bay. Crichton realizes that they'll need the pilot's help and searches for his den, and Chiana abandons Jewel to warn the others that the pod is being affected by the decay. But when Crichton finds the unfortunate pilot, he's a gibbering wreck and begs the human to kill him. Spooky.
Ooh.
So it's a cannibalism episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also an abandoned ship episode, and it's also a cloning episode. Like, you mentioned earlier that it feels like it's pulling from things that we've already seen on Farscape, and just the first thing, one of the first things that really stood out to me that was like genuinely scary was that we've seen clones on the show before, but we've never seen clones being discussed as like whether or not they are us. And
true, which, right?
It's just kind of like, oh, that's of course that's not me. That's like a weird version of me.
Right
now, it's like that is exactly me, and that's disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we had my three Crichtons,
right. And those are clearly delineated as, like, this is a past you and this is a future you. Neither of those is you.
Mm-hmm.
But the villain, whose name is Carvok, is really creepy because his whole thing is that he has the ability to clone you or twin you, as he refers to it. And then he, like, he doesn't eat the twin. What he does is he, like, puts a straw on the side of your head and then sucks the juice out, Invasion of the Body Snatchers style. And then the Zerai, which are the sort of like zombie folk that are on the ship, eat your body, and they just snack on your bones.
Yeah.
So quick little snack them.
Yeah.
And that's actually the first thing that we see that's like genuinely creepy is, well, if we're really rewinding, like everyone's in the first part of the first like room of the ship, very video game style, and then one of them walks through the door. And of course, the door closes behind them, and everyone is separated. And then Jewel and Shiana are separated from each other, and Dargo and John are together. And then Dargo gets killed very quickly because this show can't have a scary episode and also have the strongest character alive be, or like strongest character on the crew be present.
Right.
Because he would just kill things. One of the first shots of the Zerai genuinely scared the fuck out of me. It was just like the white beady eyes looking at Chiana.
Mm-hmm.
Like she kind of plays the Ripley from Aliens in this episode.
Huh. She's that's like kind of like in comparison.
Yeah, because she's armed and confident, but she's also overwhelmed, and it's a question of like getting away and not of killing everything. Especially because as we learn later, the Zerai are not a unique race; they're actually peacekeepers. Because the whole thing was that the peacekeeper ship existed as a place to hold the mentally insane, and it only held one person, which was Carvok. And he cloned the people on there so many times that they're eventually like their brains diluted and they are just basic like zombie like creatures that only can subsist on eating things, whether it be people or each other or whatever, or parts of the ship even. So that was a really good way of the like establishing the backstory and making Carvok seem really scary, was being like, yeah, everything on the ship is his fault. And they had to make a whole ship just to hold him.
Yeah, so exactly. Like, this, he's the only guy here.
Yeah,
that's
how
bad he is.
This isn't a ship for a bunch of people. This is a ship for one person.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of great color work in this episode I just wanted to bring up real quickly.
Like, mm-hmm.
That is how they contribute to it looking scary. It's like a ton of blue hues and dark lighting and all that stuff. Very deliberate, though, which I always think is cool. Yeah, I noticed also that Chiana had like weird vampire bite marks on the side of her neck from the beginning of the episode that just kind of persisted, and I was like curious if I missed something or if that just...
Yeah, I noticed those too. I wasn't so sure. I mean, it could have been the zombies, or it could have been just part of the like in medias race, there's damage kind of element of how the episode started. I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem like important. I think it was just as to kind of add to the effect.
Right.
But somebody with injuries that I wanted to talk about was the ship's pilot, because I thought that was a really creepy part. The idea that they keep cutting his arms off and eating his arms.
Ah, it's so fucked up.
Yeah, it's truly like it. Fucked.
Yeah, they...
No, not
they,
at all.
What's funny is that it's like... Or not funny, but like smart, is that it's like a thing that they talked about in an early episode where... In DNA Mad Scientist, where they were cutting pilots' arms off because they were going to use that as like payment or something, but he's going to regrow them, but you have to cut his arms off. And now we're like recalling that and doing it in like a way fucked up way.
Yeah, like that's a piece of information that we get to recycle and use again. We don't have to set a new rule, which is really cool. And then also that pilot was that Lonny Tupu doing that pilot? Is that what happened? But they changed the vocal modulation?
Nope, that is a different person. I can just say it. It's the person who does the voice of pilot before they ADR Lonny Tupu's voice in.
Oh, huh.
Yeah, fun fact.
That's cool. Yeah, so I thought that was great. It also made me realize that when they call pilot, he doesn't have a name. They're just calling him, you know, boy or like servant or... Jeeves, or I don't know.
I had that exact same thought where I was just like, oh, it's not, that's not pilot, but I guess that is pilot. It's just not our pilot.
Yeah.
There was two horror trope points that I wanted to poke a little bit of fun at. I like, first of all, they get on the ship and they get a little bit split up, and then they immediately go, the comms are down. And I'm like, God, it is so easy to take the comms down on this show. Like, we're just on a weird ship and the comms are just down. Like, what? Any little thing will take all of the comms down and we're just off. That happens frequently on this show.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, it happens all
and
the time.
And then a corny line related to that in terms of, like, silly horror tropes was, this is a good episode so far, but it wouldn't be a horror movie sort of thing if someone didn't say, please kill me, which was the pilot after he talked about the arms thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. There's just a lot of stuff like that. I think the comms thing, it just happens so often that I didn't even notice it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Qiyana starts like fighting back against the zombie things and killing them, and then she chants, and I was like, "All right, Qiyana, settle down. You're killing people right now." She's like, "Ah, la, 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 la," and you're like, "Qiyana, please! Oh my god!
Oh my god! That's right. Oh, I remember that. Oh my god, that was insane."
She got way too into it, and you're like, like I thought she was going a little crazy herself or something, but apparently she just it sometimes likes killing people. Jewel gets some interesting stuff to do in this episode. She says at one point, "I'm a civilized being. There's going to be someone here who recognizes that. I just need to find them." Which is like, huh. I guess Jewel really does rely on the fact that she is, like, takes care of herself and, like, is put together and feels, like, to herself, like, she's very stable. But that idea immediately collapses when, like, a couple more minutes into the episode, she tries to kill herself.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was, like, a not, like, ironic or funny in any way, but just, like, a very real moment for Jewel where she is like just hoping for desperately that someone gives a shit that she takes care of herself and like is the kind of person that like works to be civilized and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Crichton calls the people Crichton calls the Zarai hungry hippies, which is an amazing line. And then there's the cloning Qiyana scene, of course, where she sees herself and they both scream, and then Carvok eats one of them, or he juices one of them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I should point this out now. People, if they're listening to all the episodes, heard me say in the like season 3 prediction stuff that in the season 2 recap episode that I was saying there's gonna be a cloning plot where the argument becomes like, is the clone the same as the original or is it its own unique thing? I thought it was gonna be Aaron's son, mm-hmm. but I was close enough, and I'm totally happy about that because I feel like I'm pretty smart sometimes.
Yeah, you nailed it, dude.
Yeah, I hope that lasts, but we'll get to that. I know you want to talk about everyone's favorite scene where Dargo gets strung up and is told, "We're not going to clone you, but we need you to breed." Wait, breed with who? And then bring in the lady.
This is Julie.
Was that her name?
No, I don't know. Just like a normal person's name. This is Samantha.
you're gonna have all of this. You're gonna have a lot of sex with her. Her name's Bulima.
Mm. Oh my god, that's an odd. That's not the best name.
Bulima.
Yeah.
What's funny? I don't know if they know how sex works.
Also, by the way, the guy says we're going to make babies. I just want to put that out there.
Yes.
That's the line.
We're going to make babies. It's so funny. That is clear. They know that like that's like a funny scene because when she's like sucking on his whole situation. Qiyana comes in and she's like, and he's like, "Please get me out of this." And she's like, Am I interrupting something? I'll go. I can leave." And he's like, "No." Oh, I hate everything. Dargo's this like sad blowjob boy.
It is funny, but also is it funny because Dargo is chained up and he's about to be forced to have sex against his will, although it is coerced because he's trapped, right? So that's kind of, it's just interesting to think about the way gender plays into that scene and how we view it.
Exactly. Because on one hand it is Farscape dark comedy, but on the other hand this is a sexual assault joke. Like,
yeah.
"Oh no, please don't. I can leave. You seem like you're busy." Like that whole thing again. You gender swap that and it's immediately disgusting.
Right. And then and it was also I was actually finding it hard to tell how it was being played from Dargo's perspective, like how Dargo was actually feeling about it.
Right.
Yeah. But I think just generally speaking, like it's a scene that is kind of playing funny, but what is funny about it? And it's not, I don't know. Farscape does get a lot of humor out of really dark situations like this and out of kind of its dark play with gender and sexuality. That is very much a part of the show's DNA. So it's not that this scene felt out of place, but it is a scene that I kind of had to ask myself, how was I reacting to it and why was I reacting in the way that I was?
Oh, just if this is funny, then why is it? Or if this is trying to be funny, then why is it trying to be funny? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then it was also weird to me for Qiyana to come in because she was acting so frantically after the scene with her double to come in and have that jokey moment of like, should I leave you alone? But then I kind of interpreted it as she was just like completely dazed.
Right.
So it worked.
And then flipping the tone once again, like maybe one or two scenes later, it's Jewel trying to kill herself. Like it's this episode is like really all over the place tonally.
Yeah.
So at this point, I zoned out a lot by the end of the episode. And then when I came back, Crichton was like jumping out of an explosion, and Carvok like shot one of his big cloney bubbles, and Crichton clearly got caught in it, but it didn't seem like anything happened. And then he left, and he was like, "Hey, I'm back, folks." And then they also see another Crichton.
Uh-oh.
But did I miss anything between these scenes? I don't think there was anything.
Not really.
Huge.
I think it was like a lot of this episode is just about the tone and isn't really so much about what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's just a lot of like sneaking around and like, we're going to do Starburst and it'll mess up the ship. It'll destroy Rovu, by the way, is the name of the ship. Fun fact. So that's how they use, that's like their trump card against Carvok. And then he tries to suck Crichton's brain as the Starburst happens. And then Dargo comes and saves the day, and then he blows the thing up. Everyone's fine. But there's a twin now. And so their transport ship escapes. The control collar blows up the ship. And so, what's his name? Carvok is dead. He's on the exploded ship. And we're back on Moya. And we have another Crichton to deal with. Because we're not going to kill him, because that's not fair, because he's me. But let's play rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah. What a haunting scene.
I didn't realize until at the very end of the scene that the reason they're playing rock, paper, scissors is there's a pulse pistol between them, and whoever's going to lose is going to get shot.
Oh.
Yeah. That was, I think, at least that was like the implication, was there was a pulse pistol between them, and it was kind of like a, we're going to keep playing until someone loses, but nobody is going to lose. We are going to pick the same thing every single time. Super creepy.
Fuck.
And then Aaron and Rigel are watching, and she goes, how is he? And Rigel says, still tied. And as the two Crichtons continue to throw the same thing, they recall Carvok's words. They are both the original Crichton. No differences, perfectly equal. So now we have a clone on the ship. Yeah, what? I was curious, because you know, obviously, if the clone is going to stick around or not, right?
Yeah, I know. I spoiled some stuff. This is, like, the beginnings of a big, huge thing that I spoiled, like, when we were watching season one, and that I kept forgetting about and remembering.
And then you saw this, and you remembered it completely.
Yeah.
There is an interesting piece of background information, which we'll get to, about it, though. That's like not really a spoiler. It's like a mild spoiler, but we'll talk about it. I don't think it's gonna last too long, because I know that the whole compositing the actor twice is like really expensive and annoying to do. But I think it'll like lead to other stuff, and they're gonna get to play with the whole like, is the clone me or is it not me? Like that's gonna be a big thing.
Yeah,
for a while. But that's the end of the episode. And John, do you want to read us the background information from the Encyclopedia Project?
Do you think both of them have Harveys?
Oh, look at you with the questions. Yes, I do.
Okay. I'll read the background info. Wayne Pigram, Scorpius, does not appear in this episode. Did Crace?
Yes.
Really?
I feel like I remember seeing Crace briefly, like for like one scene in this episode.
Huh. Anthony Simcoe was in full Luxon makeup when Shiana dragged Dargo's corpse into Pilot's Den.
It's very heavy and sensitive, apparently.
The makeup?
Yes.
Mm. Rovu's pilot is voiced by Sean Masterson, who was in charge of the team that controlled Moya's pilot. He provided the voice on set during the first three seasons, which Lani Tupu later overdubbed in ADR. So I guess that makes sense. It's pretty easy casting choice. Anthony Simcoe's normal replacement was not happy to hear that on his day off, his replacement had to rehearse the scenes where Dargo is sexually molested by one of the Zerai.
What? I've read that piece of trivia like 8 times in a row, and I can't tell if I'm disgusted. I'm confused.
I think I'm disgusted.
Is the replacement saying, damn, I didn't get to pretend to be sexually molested?
I think so.
What the fuck? No, that's not a thing to be bummed out about. I'm sorry.
That's weird. Okay, whatever. Carvok was originally going to be created with a combination of makeup and animatronics, with his eyes on stocks and wearing a form of straitjacket. This was changed after Shane Bryant was cast. Yeah, that's probably good. That sounds silly.
I kind of liked the Hannibal Lecter, like, elegant put-together villain of him. Because he just, like, stands up straight and he has the little wrist thing that controls the whole ship. And, like, his first line is he just stares at someone and he's like, no, that wasn't very nice. And he just bubbles them and you're like, oh, shit, this guy doesn't fuck around. He's, like, super put together and or, like, composed. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to say that.
When confronting each other on Pilot's Tier, Crichton refers to Carvok as a sick, hammer horror son of a bitch. In the 1970s, Shane Bryant, the actor portraying Carvok, starred in several films from the British studio renowned for its classic horror movies, Hammer Film Productions. Oh.
Easter eggs.
So this guy has been around the horror block before.
For sure.
Carvok's method of extracting and digesting brains was inspired by the Vincent Price movie, The Abominable Mr. Phibbs. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy McIntosh was so involved in the scene that her heartbeat was audible on the soundtrack when Jewel was terrified.
That's cool. Awesome.
Guy Gross added a shakuhachi, a Japanese flute, to the score to give it an unusual mix.
Successful.
Yeah. Ian Watson wanted the characters to deteriorate as the episode wore on, so he worked up four different levels of makeup for the principal cast. Oh, I see. Huh.
That maybe explains also the blood stuff. That's like part one of a four-part makeup stage.
Mm-hmm. Once shooting on the episode was complete, it took 4 days for the corridor sets to be returned to normal.
Oh, because it was this, I guess this was like maybe the Moya or something?
Yeah, that's actually a really rad thought, that they're somewhere completely different, but they're still using that Moya set. And you forget.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. Like, I didn't even, that didn't even cross my mind that they were probably using the Moya set, or that they definitely were.
TV magic.
Mm-hmm. This episode is considered one of the most controversial in the series history.
I read that, and I want to ask the listeners who have, the lovely crew members who have watched and, like, consumed more of the show than we have,
mm-hmm.
what exactly was controversial? Because I've heard that part of it is, like, some people didn't like the idea of the clone, some people thought the sexual molesting stuff was not okay. There's a lot of different things, so I'm curious what that was, because I didn't get it. Like, why would this be a very controversial episode?
Yeah, that piece of trivia is sourced to an episode review on farscapeworld.com. So if you feel like you're intrigued by what that piece of background information means, then you can check out that review, because that's where it's coming from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but also we would love to hear from people as well. And there's one more piece of background information, I guess. This isn't a spoiler.
Yeah, this is the one I was saying. I'm not sure if this is like a big thing or not. Yeah. It's a weird way to write it.
This episode marks the final time the two Johns have all the same memories.
I guess all that means is they are not going to continue to live the exact same life from here on. Like, they're going to become two separate. Like, they're going to live differently. Right. Mm-hmm. That's all. But that's interesting and has implications of something really cool.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot in the Illustrated Companion that wasn't already in there. There's a lot of cute set photos, though, of the Zarai, like, looking at Chiana and Dargo, just kind of being like, oh, hey, we're all here. We're, like, eating lunch together and stuff. But in makeup. So, it's the illustrated part of the Illustrated Companion.
Gotcha.
But I think that's it for Eat Me. An interesting episode with some cool stuff that's going to come back very soon. Magellan, do you want to take the wheel and take us all the way over to Planet Netflix and let us know what's going on next week on Scape Chats?
Whoa. All right. Next week, we're watching two episodes. Season 3, Episode 7, Thanks for Sharing. Crichton has been cloned. Moya's crew, trying to buy a healing agent for the injured gunship Talon, becomes embroiled in a planet's deadly politics. That's the first one. Second one is Season 3, Episode 8, Green-Eyed Monster. When Talon is swallowed by a giant space creature, Krace's neural connection to Talon malfunctions, and he asks Aaron to help him control the gunship.
Huh.
So we got some Talon action.
Heck yeah. Magellan, do you want to let's do some housekeeping, actually, before we take it home.
Let's do it.
You can email us, scapechats@gmail.com, if you have questions, comments, or concerns. We have a Reddit thread every week, reddit.com/r/farscape. You can follow the show on Twitter, @scapechats, where we also take questions and stuff. And we can reply there pretty easily. We have a Tumblr, scapechats.tumblr.com. And I can be found personally on Twitter. That's twitter.com/AlanIbrahim, AlanIbrahim. And Magellan, what would you like to plug for yourself?
Oh, it's just my Twitter. You can find me at justafluke, JustaFluke. I don't use it very often, but if you shoot me a little message, I'll hit you up.
I'll send you some stuff. I think that is an episode, Magellan.
That's a whole episode we did.
That's a whole... Warts and all. Hopefully that was a good listening experience for y'all, because we had some Skype issues.
Sorry for that bad one. It was awful.
No, I thought it was a great episode that was marred by technical issues partly through. But that happens. I can probably smooth out some of that.
Smoothie out.
But, smoothie it out. Let's go grab a smoothie and get the frill out of here.